This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Mark Dwyer is back with us today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He's a speaker, educator, and author and has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. And we're going to take a look at adding grasses to your garden and take your calls. What gardening questions or comments do you have? Join in by calling 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Jill. How are you?
I'm well. Hope you are, too. It's a beautiful day, but it's a little chilly.
It is. It's that hint of autumn, which is, of course, here on the calendar. But I think tonight in southern Wisconsin, we're going to get close to frost. So it's Mother Nature is giving us a reality check.
Yes, unfortunately, it is coming our way. And I'm very sad because when I left my house this morning, I saw that even though it didn't get freezing last night, my sweet potato vine looks like it got hit. They're pretty susceptible, aren't they?
They are, but to have them look good until the first week of October is you know, that's a testimony to your green thumbs.
Well, I don't know about that, but they look so pretty. They're, you know, and I really hate to say goodbye, but, you know, that's the way it is, I guess. So if we are supposed to be getting a frost tonight, what do you suggest for maybe extending the season? Do you cover your plants or what do you do?
Well, I know some folks will do that. You know, when you think about the time and money invested in things like sensitive annuals, you know, your sweet potato vine is an example. The idea that, at least in our portion of the state, it'll be a light enough frost that protective blankets or some covering, or even if you have the opportunity to bring containers inside or into the garage, you can do that and prolong the show because the long-range forecast, at least in our area, doesn't seem to have hard frost for a couple more weeks after this. So, but the reality is, you know, you have to segue into your fall activities out in the garden and putting the garden to bed. So the decision is really a personal one, but there are ways to lengthen the show. But what I'm doing today is picking green tomatoes in advance of the frost to not have anything go to waste and hopefully, you know, be ready for winter when it descends upon us.
Yes, for sure. So how do you ripen your green tomatoes? What's your method?
Well, there's a couple ways of doing it. You know, you can put them on a sunny windowsill and keep them rotated, and they'll eventually ripen. You really need to keep an eye on them, though, making sure they're not getting soft or compromised. Some folks will put them in a paper bag. Collectively, the ethylene is what helps ripen the tomatoes in time. And I have a friend who actually puts green tomatoes in a cooler. And not to just to keep the temperature kind of regulated and carries them over for months into the winter and just pops it open and we'll pick some of the ripest ones out. So if folks get online, there's lots of suggestions on how to ripen tomatoes. But don't let those green tomatoes go to waste. They can be put into sauces or fried green tomatoes. And, you know, there's things you can do.
There sure are. Well, let's get to that ornamental grass subject that I talked about at the beginning here. What do ornamental grasses bring to a garden?
Well, I think this is a great time of year to really observe that. As folks are driving around, we're distracted by fall colors, which is understandable. We're appreciating that last burst of color. But grasses really come into the forefront in the fall and in winter landscape, offering texture, movement, color. I think it's important to mention that grasses in a landscape or garden setting shouldn't just be contributors late in the season. You know, not just hey, now I notice that grass in October.
Right.
That grass should have been, you know, a contributor throughout the season. But, you know, there's so many wonderful grasses, including some excellent natives, that really prolong the show well into winter and provide wildlife habitat in terms of seeds and shelter. So grasses, I think, are indispensable in our landscapes.
And they look so beautiful, such a nice contrast to some of our other plantings. What do we have to be careful of when we select ornamental grass varieties?
Well, a couple things to consider. First of all, you know your plant, as you should with any any perennial or woody plant, you know, grass is falling under our perennial discussion here. Know the plant in terms of how it grows. And that means how to keep it happy. You know, does it like sun? What sort of soil? What sort of watering regime? But also, is there a concern about it spreading, whether by seed or rhizomes? What, you know, is it a grass that you'll regret planting? And there are some that are sold as ornamental grasses that can have a tendency to move about. So you do need to know that. But it's equally important, I feel, when you consider the late season contributions of grasses, is to consider those that have significant winter stature. Because ornamental grasses are touted as, hey, here's a low-maintenance plant, which, first of all, is not always the case. But second of all, they're promoted as, hey, great winter interest. They'll stay up through the snows and they'll offer texture in the winter garden. Well, not all grasses are created equally. So those that lack winter stem strength just get flattened. And that's okay. They did something else earlier in the season, but there are specific varieties that have more rigid stems that can withstand that snow and rain and ice. And so do ask those pointed questions at the nurseries and garden centers, you know, what are some real good late season grasses?
Are there any alternatives, or what can you do if that grass is kind of getting out of control? 'Cause that happens.
It's challenging because I'm not a huge chemical fan, but, you know, something that we notice in our area of the state, and I'm sure throughout the Midwest, there's some of the maiden grass or Japanese silver grass that is along the roadsides, which looks, what you see is a massive cluster of white plumes right now, mm-hmm. 6 or 7 feet tall, turning yellowish, really looking quite beautiful. But what you see is just an absolute thicket of this miscanthus. And the challenge there is that is spreading through root runners. And the idea of manual control, you know, going out there and spraying with a shovel, forget it. It's impossible. Maybe heavier duty mechanized equipment might help, but herbicides sometimes have to be relied upon for those that are spreading voraciously through the landscape. But here, a great example, though, is our native switchgrass. And there's many cultivated varieties, a lot of excellent varieties. Switchgrass in open soils, a garden that has a lot of open soil, open space, can see some receding. You can see switchgrass receding, which is how it proliferates. It's how it reproduces, of course. But if that garden, same garden, had a mulch layer, had been mulched, you don't see that sort of seeding issue. So there's things you can do in the context of how you garden to minimize the spread of the plant. But the best step is to know well in advance before you even put it in the ground that it might be a problem.
Do you have some favorite ornamental grasses that you like to use?
Well, you know, I mentioned the switchgrass, which is a huge favorite, but what we're seeing is some of our native grasses to the prairies, like big blue stem, little blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass, prairie drop seed. These are absolutely fabulous grasses that 25 years ago were relegated to prairie restorations and meadows and such. And they're coming to the forefront of our landscape gardens because they're now selecting specific varieties that have a little more ornamentality. And a great example would be big blue stem. There's some excellent varieties that have been selected for a more intense fall color, like a brilliant red or a maroon that really looks great in the landscape. So I tend to lean on the natives because they're adapted to our soils. They thrive. They're great in a wildlife-friendly garden. Not to say there aren't some non-natives that are worth their salt out in our gardens, but for us, shopping locally, you can find a wide spectrum of these nativars, as they're called, varietal sections of native grasses that fit the bill for height and for interest, and also many include that winter stature that we talked about earlier.
And they're beautiful. Now, as far as care goes, obviously, we want winter interest. You don't want to cut them down right now. But what do we do in the spring? Do we cut them back, or do we let them just kind of grow back?
Well, when you think of, you know, the grass doesn't have an interest necessarily in being cut back. And by saying that, I mean, you think about where these plants grow natively. They send up new growth and they replace the old. But in a cultivated setting, a garden, I recommend getting out there in later March before you see any active growth and cutting back as far as you can. That's usually 2 to 3 inches for some of the thicker grasses. Clear that old debris, make room for the new. And there are what are termed both cool season and warm season grasses, which is a longer discussion, but in essence, cool season grasses emerge very early in April, at least in the southern portion of the state. So you really want to clear that debris in March and make room for the new growth, because there's a danger if the new growth is blending with the old, it becomes more difficult to separate the two. So I like a clean look for maintenance, but keep in mind, as with all perennials, as these grasses expand, the most vigorous growth is on the outside of the plant. This happens with our hostas, it happens with our rudbeckias, it happens with many of our perennials. So what you see in time with an ornamental grass is it with its vigorous growth extending on the exterior, you start to lose some of the original growth in the center, which creates what I term a donut,
right.
Meaning so in the spring, your new growth looks like a donut. And the danger with a donut for any perennial, including grasses, of course, is you're losing that center portion of growth, and it can be a little more floppier and just a wider, more unkempt plant. And that signals the need for division, which can be laborious with many grasses. But grasses do benefit from division, as do many other perennials.
What's the best way to do that? To dig it up and cut it into pieces? Is that what you would do?
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, that's what it boils down to. And when you think of division of like a hosta, and many of your listeners, I'm sure, have done this, or daylilies, I mean, you get in there and you slice them up, and sometimes you excavate and sort of separate them. But do a little research on the type of grass you're dividing, because some of the larger grasses, and let's use that big blue stem and the switchgrass as an example, you're not going to be able to put even a sharp spade in the ground and slice into it. You're not going to be able to divide it in ground. There are some grasses that you can do that with, like feather reed grass, some of the fescues. There are some grasses with less tough root systems that you can divide and kind of chunk up in the ground and move about. But to your point, Jill, the idea of these larger grasses, it really necessitates excavation, which is like digging up a shrub. And I don't want to dissuade people from using the grasses, but you're digging up this really massive root system, and you're slicing and dicing with a hacksaw. I've heard of people sacrificing a chainsaw blade.
Oh, I mean, my.
it's a vigorous process, and it really benefits from happening early in the season when that donut is just barely starting to show growth. You excavate it, slice and dice, and move things around. And but there is some elbow grease involved.
Well, that's really good to know. So you're prepared. I use a serrated bread knife for my hostas. I don't think that would work very well with these grasses, then.
Yeah, you could for some. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Tough to say.
Well, we're talking with Mark Dwyer. He has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, so he can answer pretty much most of your questions. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So join in the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our on-air producer today is Clara Neipert, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us every Friday or listen again on Saturday mornings at 6. And you can also go online and listen to our archives at any time. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, we'll look at overwintering berries with Vijay Pandian. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, we are talking with Mark Dwyer, and we have a phone call, Mark. So let's go right to Jason in Milwaukee. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
What can we help you with?
So my question is, I'm looking at planting some grasses, but I've got two large black walnut trees, and my understanding is that their root system and leaves can actually be quite toxic for some plants, and I'm trying to get a better understanding of that.
Oh, I understand that completely, Jason. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, the challenge with walnut trees is the entire tree, particularly the root system, emits a hormone called juglone. And to make a long story short, it's a great mechanism for that tree to minimize competition around the crown or around the root system. Now, I will say that there's actually more things that you can grow under a walnut than you can't. And I found some of the best sources for the good and the bad around a walnut are from the Morton Arboretum. And if you hop on the internet and look up Morton Arboretum walnut toxicity, you'll get some great references. And also Ohio State University has done an amazing study that also includes some massive lists. As it relates to grasses, there's quite a few native sedges, and some of our native grasses are absolutely fine under the walnut. So it's a matter of specific research based on what you're looking for. Although you bring up an interesting point, I do want to mention when we talk about planting grasses, I alluded to both cool season and warm season grasses. If you're this time of year for good root establishment, we're running out of time to plant grasses. And now there's perennials, other perennials I'm more comfortable planting late in the season, but those warm season grasses, I'm wary at this point in time. So your best time to plant those taller warm season grasses that I mentioned, big blue stem, little blue stem, et cetera, really is spring. So if you find a deal this time of year, get them in the ground and mulch them heavily. But back to the walnut thing, a little more research, and you'll actually find a good list of things you can grow.
Great. Well, thanks for the call, Jason. Good luck with that. And we were just mentioning that, you know, our growing season is winding down. But are there still plants that are, what are the plants that are still blooming? I've seen quite a few of them. What are some that maybe home gardeners would want to try?
Well, since we haven't had frost yet, and I'm presuming it's happened further north in the state. Mm-hmm. You know, the challenge when you consider, you know, as gardeners, we want to see color in the garden, and we're getting our fall colors. But when we talk specifically about bloom time, the latest blooming plants, that becomes the challenge because they're certainly compromised by heavy frost. But this time of year in my home garden, I have some goldenrods that are still blooming, some monk's hoods. Particularly some of the taller, real deep blue and maroon forms are blooming late in the season. There's a little ornamental onion called Ozawa, O-Z-A-W-A, that is just blooming now, beautiful pink. And these plants I'm mentioning actually can take a light frost and continue to bloom. And there's also some perennial mums, and not just the mums we're buying late in the season for late season color. That's certainly valid, but there's some mums called single Korean apricot, which is a pink, and one called Clara Curtis, which is a yellow. Clara Curtis is also a pink, and Mary Stoker is the yellow. But the common is there's, you know, 12 to 15 flowering perennials that'll go the distance until you get that, you know, 25, 26 degrees, and they really get knocked back. So mm-hmm. on a day like today, and where I'm sitting, it's going to be 55 degrees, but I'm already seeing pollinators, and I've seen some hummingbirds working their way through. So the season's not up in terms of providing those flowers for wildlife as well.
That's a very good point, because I know a lot of people are saying hummingbirds are still here. I'm assuming they're going to take off pretty soon, but yeah, it's nice to have something for them to fill up on. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Katie in Eau Claire. Hi, Katie. What can we help you with?
Hi. I just planted a bunch of native plants we got from Prairie Nursery, and I planted them about 2 weeks ago, and I'm in the Eau Claire area, so I'm curious, with them being brand new plants, should we, like, cover them up extra good this year, or, like, start covering them now since it's getting colder?
Well, great question. So Prairie Nursery, incidentally, excellent resource. So top-notch plants. That's out of Westfield, Wisconsin. Really good stuff. So the late planting isn't as much of a concern to me as you want to continue to water them, obviously, you know, until the ground freezes. So I would water past Halloween, give them a little dose of water, not, you know, waterlogging them. But in terms of coverage, I absolutely wouldn't cover them at this point. I would wait till you get some more heavier frost as you head into November, and then consider maybe some loose straw or some shredded leaves just as a light layer, maybe an inch or two over the top, as just a little insulating layer. And it's less about insulating for the winter, it's just more about regulating temperature when we get back into March. Because the hope is you get some nice snow cover to be a beautiful blanket over those plants. But they're all tough as nails, and these next couple of weeks, the soil is still quite warm for you, so they'll be setting root. So keep watering, light mulch after it gets a little colder.
Okay, thank you, Katie. Let's go now to Craig in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Craig.
Yeah, good morning. So I heard you talking about walnut. I recently had some trees cleared from my property, and I had them chip it for me. And when I was spreading it, I noticed those green balls from walnut trees that was in there. And I'm wondering, it didn't come from my property. I'm wondering, having spread it, am I going to cause any problems?
Great question. And it's the concern about walnuts, and so the entire plant has that hormone. And incidentally, this includes butternuts and hickories to a certain degree, but walnuts for the most part. The concern with using walnut mulch when it's fresh is it has that inhibiting property in the landscape for at least a year, sometimes 2 years, minimally. So my concern is, if you see some yellowing or some damage to plants where the mulch has surrounded it, I would be very concerned. Years ago, when I was at Rotary Botanical Gardens, we received a load of shredded walnut chips, and thankfully they identified it for us. And we actually put it in the back for like 5 years. We just left it alone. It actually became a pretty nice mulch, but our concern again was perpetuation of that hormone well beyond the chipping stage. So again, the direct answer is I'd be concerned.
For sure. I know, and even when I had black walnuts where I used to live, the squirrels would spread them all over the place. So even in beds that were far away from the trees, you'd still have a problem because there were black walnuts in there. So, right. Yeah, keep an eye on that. Maureen in Green Bay is up next. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, is it a bad idea to mix a product like Miracle-Gro Moisture Control Potting Mix or something similar into poor soil to amend it for like a planting bed?
That's a great question. You know, I think if I had a little extra in a bag like that and I was amending a bed, I would toss it on there, but I wouldn't use it as my primary means of amendment. I have two concerns. That first of all, the moisture retentiveness qualities of some of those potting soils are actually excessive, meaning I think they retain too much moisture. So I rarely use those even in container arrangements, just because I feel like the soil stays too wet. So that translated to your garden, I would be a little concerned. I feel that the best way to amend your soil, and I don't know what you have in terms of original soils, but there's, you know, composting and adding organic amendments that will help increase the tilth, you know, the structure of the soil and the nutrient capacity, and also moisture holding beyond the chemicals in Miracle-Gro. So I don't, you know, I again, if you have something you need to use up, I wouldn't, you know, and you disperse it, I wouldn't worry about it, but I wouldn't, you know, go buy 20 bags and use that as a way to amend your, you know, a garden bed. You know, get some compost and something maybe a little more beneficial.
Okay, thank you, Maureen. John in Elgin, Illinois. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, I have a problem with switchgrass and little blue stem that midway through the summer they just start flopping over, especially the little blue stem. The person that put my gardens in said my soil is so rich, it's good, really deep black dirt. That you said that causes that problem. Is there any way around that?
Yeah, great question. And if you hadn't supplied that information in terms of your soil, I would have said, I bet your soil's too rich for those grasses. And so the grasses aren't minding the richness, but what you're getting is so much vegetative growth, they're getting top heavy. So that is a concern with a lot of the native grasses that don't need to be overly pampered. So one of the ways you can address that is literally, it sounds crazy, but to dig up that grass and modify at least that root zone with some leaner soils, if possible, because that'll continue to happen. And, you know, I always tell people with these grasses, you don't need to fertilize them. You don't need to, you know, heavily compost the soil for them to thrive. They're all deep rooted and they'll adapt to such a wide range of soil. So there's not an easy answer on how to minimize the floppiness beyond making your soil a little leaner in those locations.
Okay, thank you very much, John. Our guest today on Garden Talk is Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. If you have any questions, you can give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we do have an email from Bonnie in Wanakee. She said that she's blessed with too many chipmunks, and she's usually okay with them, but this summer they crossed the line because they ate most of her blueberries. berries. So she has a blueberry cage around the plants, but they still got in. The bottom two-thirds is chicken wire, and the top third is bird netting. Bonnie's considering replacing it with hardware cloth, but hasn't figured it out yet. Plus, wondering if the pollinators will be able to get through the hardware cloth. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions?
Boy, that's a tough one. You know, aside from planting a lot more blueberries to distract that chipmunk population. The challenge in going to hardware cloth is probably the way to go. And you don't want anything, if you had a half inch grid is sufficient for most pollinators to get in there and is good for deterring chipmunks, even a 3/4 inch grid. So I wouldn't worry about the pollinators not being able to access it. But keep in mind, whatever device you use to cover the plant, make sure it's pinned down securely along all the edges or actually dug into the soil a little bit. Because my guess is whether they're finding a gap up top or it's very likely they're finding a gap down low. And it takes a very small space for them to get in. So, again, make sure you have a solid connection with ground level and perhaps below grade, because they can do some digging as well, obviously. So it's not hard to get under a structure that's flush with the soil level.
Do you think that hardware cloth is the way to go with pretty much everything, trees, shrubs, perennials?
Well, it's tough. To be honest, I don't spend a lot of time doing it unless it's a very specific plant. My entire horticultural career has been, I've put blinders on in terms of deer damage, woodchucks, rabbits, all of that happens. I'm trying to do more research and observations on growing stuff that they tend to leave alone. So to your question, Jill, the hardware cloth, it can be effective, but our wildlife is quite intelligent and can find ways around just about anything. So, get online and chat with other gardeners and see what they've come up with. But we know it's impossible to protect everything in our yard. So we make wise choices on things that will avoid and also certainly take the time to protect our most important plants.
Oh, for sure. The rabbits have done havoc this year on my yard. And it's not even like they've got plenty of grass to eat. So, So if anybody has suggestions for keeping rabbits off of shrubs, please let me know. I would appreciate that. Let's go back to the phones. Mike in Oshkosh, you have a question?
Yeah, I have some clumps of decorative grass in the front of my house. They're in an area that has decorative stone around them, and they've probably been in there about 15 years. They're, I'm not sure what type they are, but they're kind of a blue-green grass. They get about 2 feet tall, I would say, and the clumps have gotten to the point where there it seems to be so much dry old grass at the bottom that the last couple of years they just don't grow like we'd like them to. They seem to be stunted by all of this dead growth at the bottom. Is there anything I can do with those other than replacing them?
Well, great question. And, you think about wherever those grasses grow natively, obviously the mechanism for regrowth and shedding the old growth exists. And so the congestion, I think, can be alleviated by a real severe cutback after the winter. And also something called finger combing. Like if you were, let's say you've cut this thing back literally as far as you can, and you're looking down at a lot of brown stubble, get some gloves on and go through there vigorously with either a rake or your fingers with gloves on. By the way, always wear gloves with handling grasses, or you'll get the equivalent of the worst paper cut you've ever had in the webbing between your fingers.
Very true.
I could go on about that, but I would really be rough with it to try to break up some of that congestion. And the other thought is actually do that division, excavate it, chunk it apart and try to get some of that debris off and just replant a portion of the plant. And that tends to encourage brand new growth, which may help push some of that old stuff off. So I don't think it's a lost cause. I don't think I'd buy new grass yet. I would just beat up what you have and really encourage it to set some new growth.
Thanks, Mike. Mark, he had gravel around that. Does that make any difference as far as the growth of the plants?
Well, the challenge with the rock mulching, I don't know that the depth of the rock mulching or if there's fabric underneath, but for grasses that start to expand, and they all do, we talked about the donut stage, they have a hard time. It's impossible for them to go beyond the opening that's been cut in that fabric. So a lot of the new growth gets pushed up into the existing plant. So some of the congestion, I'm glad you brought that up, Jill, some of the congestion might be because of that. So if that rock mulch, again, is over an opening in fabric, you could remove the rock mulch, widen the fabric a little bit, or go back to that division and just replant a chunk and let it do its thing. But in more traditional open gardens where there's not heavier mulches, the grasses continue to get wider, and that's why they push new growth. The most vigorous, youthful growth is on the outside. So maybe that's part of the problem.
Okay, great. Thank you. We got an email from a listener who just bought a mum plant, as many of us have. It has buds that are just starting to open, but we always have that question. Can they plant it in the ground now?
The short answer is yes, and I'm assuming part of the question is an expectation of it coming back in the future. And
right.
You know, the garden mums that we're purchasing, and we should patronize our local garden centers and nurseries, and a lot of folks use them as annuals. You know, they put them in containers, and that's it. And then they go in the compost pile when they lose color. The majority of what's being sold are perennial mums. The challenge is they're putting energy into the blooms, not so much rooting. So if I had those mums, I absolutely would plant them. And my wife and I, by the way, when garden debris goes out curbside in Janesville, we pick the mums out of people tossing mums out. We take the mums home and we plant them. And what we do is we let them turn brown, which is usually November. We cut that stubble to an inch or two, and then we bury them with 5 or 6 inches of loose leaves. And we've had a really good success rate. And we keep them watered. But again, it's a crapshoot because they're not going to put a lot of energy into rooting. So you hope for a good snow. That mulch will help, the additional watering. So it's I'm giving a diatribe here, but it's worth planting. Just, you know, don't cross your fingers and hope for the best. But
sure.
do that cut back to stubble, mulch them, keep them watered, and they may be back for you.
Yeah. I've had hit or miss luck with doing that. And usually then they come back. If they come back the next year, they die the year after that. It can't hurt, right? Can't hurt.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones again, and we'll go to Eau Claire. And Susie, what do you have for us?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have access to a lot of grass clippings that I would like to use for mulch on my flower garden and then, you know, combine them into my soil. But I know the clippings have either been fertilized at one time or had weed control at one time. I just want to know, you know, how should I wait or what should I do or how should I incorporate the mulch or the weed clippings into my flower beds without hurting my flowers?
Well, it's a great question, and not knowing specifically what the inputs were into that turf, and maybe you don't know all the inputs either, the concern would be using them directly. Now, even if you had mentioned these clippings are from an organic lawn, no treatment at all, my concern would be if you're using them immediately, the challenges are they need nitrogen as they break down. So the concern is you're adding them as a mulch to benefit other plants, but yet they may be become detrimental to that situation. So it's one thing to leave light clippings when you're mowing, but if you're piling clippings, the other thing is they can become matted down if you lay them too thick, which actually can tend to repel water, not necessarily keep it moist. So I'm giving you a lot of the cons of using them directly. But back to the chemical thing, my concern, if you have any concerns, and it sounds like you do, I would compost that material. I would compost it or not use it at all because the concern is perpetuating those chemicals into other portions of your garden. Okay. So, again, it's tough to say not knowing all the inputs, but I would lean away from using them directly and minimally compost them or not use it at all.
Okay, thank you very much, Susie. You know, I use my grass clippings for mulch a lot, but I spread them out really, really thin and then just add a layer every time I cut the grass. It seems to work okay.
Yeah, the light layer is important, and it breaks down very quickly. But mm-hmm. I grew up with my dad piling lawn clippings on the garden, and it literally, he'd have a 5 or 6 inch layer of these lawn clippings, and he thought it was good. And what it was doing was robbing nitrogen out of the soil to a certain degree, but it created a matted down situation, and none of the plants were thriving that had that heavy mulch. So,
oh, sure. That makes sense. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Okay. Jim in Prairie du Chien, what can we do for you?
Yes. I'm calling about a problem that we have with voles and wondered if you might have any recommendations for control. They're especially damaging to hosta and root crops in our garden, just devastating almost everything that we have is being attacked by them. And we're really not sure just what the best technique would be to try to control them, or better yet, eliminate them, short of putting poison on our garden, which we really don't want to do. So I wondered if you had any suggestions.
Okay, that might be a little outside your wheelhouse, Mark. Have you had vole problems?
Not so much in the past. We had a little bit of an issue at Rotary Gardens at one time, but I believe there's a UW Extension publication on voles, if I'm not mistaken. And I really don't have some good advice. I certainly sympathize with that problem because they can be extremely destructive when that population peaks. And but I think there is some research that's been done to give you some guidance, short of, you know, a lethal approach that can deter them. But I'm probably not the one to lay that out for you.
Yeah, and I know we've had Scott Craven on a number of times, and that topic comes up a lot. So if you reach out to Scott, I'm sure he probably could help you, too, if there's not someone in Prairie du Chien that can help you at the Extension or that publication. So, yeah, Google, do some Googling, Jim. Good luck. That can be so discouraging.
Yeah,
for sure. Okay, so we are talking with at Garden Talk today with Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Join in with your questions. We have one line open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us on Monday when we talk to our tech expert about how to use technology to keep your home safe. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. And right now we are talking gardening with Mark Dwyer. And let's go right back to the phones. Steve in Boulder Junction has a great question. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I've got a lawn where I'd like to replace part of the lawn and make a living snow fence to the north side of my driveway so I don't have snow drifting in so much. So obviously I need something that'll stand up during the winter, and I'd like to have some flowering of some sort so there's some summer interest. The area is about shaded maybe 30 or 50% of the day.
So your interest in having this snow fence is having material that, you know, obviously has a rigidity to deal with the snow, but also is offering interest in the summer. Do you have a feel on what height would work best for you?
Oh, 3 feet or higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and there's plenty of woody shrubs that would help take care of that issue. And I think, you know, ultimately the decision becomes spacing. You know, because you want these to intertwine and create this thicketing approach that again minimizes that snowdrift across the driveway there. You know, there's some great shrubs like nine barks, a wide range of nine barks that can take a certain degree of part sun, offering some nice colorful interest. There's golden forms and maroon forms, although I would lean on the shorter selections. There are some real tall ones, but there's a nice one called Little Devil that gets about 4 feet tall. That is a nice one. Spacing, again, becomes a challenge because you want to make sure that these, again, intertwine but also provide coverage all the way to the ground so nothing's sneaking through. So that's something to keep in mind as well. A non-native nine barks are native to North America, by the way, but a utilitarian shrub that has done extremely well in a wide range of situations is privet. And privet's been around for quite some time, and there's some privets now that are sterile. There's not the concern of seeds or anything of that nature, but privet can take sun or shade, can be easily sheared into any height, And there's a neat variety now called Straight Talk, which is quite narrow, that ultimately, you know, side by side would create a nice barrier for you. Although, again, you need, you know, X amount to cover your lineal footage. The other thought is not necessarily planting all of one thing. You know, there's the opportunity to mix it up a little bit, not just a single row. It depends on how much real estate you do want to use up. But, you know, with the discussion of grasses, some of our ornamental grasses, like those switchgrasses, there's an excellent variety called Northwind, which is comes out of Northwind Perennial Farm, which is near Lake Geneva. This is a very rigid, upright grass. Now, it'll get taller than 3 feet, but those side-by-side would actually buffer a lot of the snow as well. So there's no real shortage of opportunities to create this sort of living fence, this snow tripper, as it's called. But perhaps talk to your local garden center or nursery and see what they might suggest as well.
And they always look so pretty when they're more than one variety, don't they?
Yeah, I think mixing it up is good. And, you know, when you think about a larger scale version of this, you know, you think about folks in open areas where a windbreak to the north and west, the idea of these farmsteads having rows of evergreens to deflect a lot of that wind coming out of the northwest in winter, they're really pushing now for multi-featured windbreaks. So not just a row of spruce trees, but incorporating service berries, elderberries, you know, native plants that provide habitat for wildlife as well. Now you're dedicating more square footage to this mixed border, but you're actually getting a really nice dense planting. And there's lots of research on windbreaks and suggestions online on how to do this.
And if a disease comes through, you don't lose everything.
That's a huge concern, and we've seen it with I've seen rows of 50-year-old Colorado blue spruce in the Midwest that were well-intentioned back in 1960 as a windbreak, but they've succumbed to Cytospora and all the various cankers and diseases and lost all their lower limbs. So the wind is just whipping right underneath those. So there's not an additional layer of protection. And that's, you know, again, multi-width and species approach to these makes sense. But that snow tripper suggestion, I think there's a wide range of really hardy plants that would do well.
Absolutely. And we wanted to talk about some conifers that are good for winter interest in our gardens. So let's talk a little bit about that before we go back to the phones. What suggestions do you have, Mark?
Well, not too dissimilar to grasses. I would echo what I said earlier in that you don't plant conifers just for winter interest, but we're heading into a winter where you'll start to notice conifers and the blues, the yellows, the, you know, green's a color too. We know that. So conifers are the bones of our garden. Now, we have to be wary if you're in an area with deer. We know that things like arborvitae and white pine like to be nibbled. The deer have a palate for a wide range of conifers, which seems to be expanding. But your placement of conifers can be ornamental, you know, framing a view, blocking a view, creating a framework. But I really like to lean on gold and blues with conifers, whether they're larger ones or smaller in the landscape, because they're contributing those colors 365 days of the year. So, again, there's a wide range of opportunities out there, but examine your winter garden for lapses of interest that might be fulfilled with the addition of grasses and colorful conifers next year. So our winter garden should include those elements and colorful stems and ornamental bark and berries and fun things, but examine every season for lapses and address accordingly.
Okay, great advice as always. And let's go back to the phones here. Liz in Stevens Point has a question. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I was gifted a bunch of cannas, and they grew beautifully all summer. I know that I need to dig them up. I'm pretty sure I know how to store them, but I don't know when to dig them up.
Well, great question. Cannas are the gift that keeps on giving, and as you've alluded to, they're certainly not winter hardy in the ground, so the idea of lifting them and storing them is imperative to perpetuate them going forward. So what I do is I actually wait for the first frost. And I lived in Stevens Point, so I know your climate. You could dig them today if you wanted. That would be fine, but I wait for a hard frost and all that, the stem and foliage to blacken, excavate, cut that stem low to the rhizome, to that tuberous root system, rinse it off entirely, get all the soil off, And then you mentioned you know how to store them, but for other listeners, it's important to make sure they're in a cool, dry space at about 55 degrees if you can. And whether you pack them in dry peat moss or sawdust or even air store them, put them in crates. And there's lots of online references on how to do it. They're very easy to store, but it's really important to get all that soil off and do that. But I'll be tending to do that again after the first frost because they won't be hurt. The rhizomes won't be hurt with frost. You just don't want to leave them too late in the ground, of course.
Yeah, that makes it a little difficult to take them up, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Liz. Let's go to Janesville. Kathy, what can we help you with?
Well, I have a small vegetable garden that I've been tearing up. It's in my front yard along with some flowers. And as I'm digging, I'm finding some what look like potatoes, but I think they're fungi of some type. Some are hard and they're dark blue inside. Others have exploded and are sending out spores. I want to know if they're harmful and if I should get rid of them or how do I get rid of them?
Huh. Well, that
interesting.
I don't know. I'm curious. I think your best bet, and the short answer is I don't know. The fact that they may be fungal bodies, so something is decaying, or there's something conducive to obviously to their growth. So, but it's a great question. Are they deleterious to what you want to grow or the soil? I would collect those and/or take photos and take them down to the Rock County Courthouse, the Extension office there. I think we share an extension agent with Walworth County. I'm also in Janesville. But ultimately get another opinion on what they are, and they'll be able to identify it fairly quickly and give you better information. But I'm very curious. But I'm glad you're kind of figuring out what's going on because it's intriguing.
Very much so. I'm sure aliens had nothing to do with that, Kathy, so don't be concerned. Let's go to Cindy. She's in Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I have about 12 small redbud saplings that have been started by seed this past summer. And right now they are about 8 inches tall, and they're in pots, and I've heeled them into the garden up to the soil line, the natural soil line of the pots that they're in. But my question is, how do I overwinter them?
Well, actually, what you've done is just fine for the root hardiness. So if you hadn't mentioned healing them in, that's what was the direction I was thinking as you were giving your story. So keeping them in the pots and having them healed in where they're insulated with current soil temperatures is just fine. What I would consider is our earlier chat about hardware cloth giving a little protection, because my concern is if you get a lot of snow cover and get some nibblers under there, you'd hate to have those girdled or chewed upon this winter. So it's less about making it through the winter in terms of hardiness. My concern would be critters, so I would protect them to some degree. But it sounds like they'll be just fine with what you've done already. Just an additional critter protection.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. Gary in Platteville, you're next.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have two oak trees. I planted them from very small. One's about an inch and a half in diameter. One's an inch in diameter. I want to move one of them. They're about 5 foot apart right now, and I wasn't sure if they both would survive. I'm looking at removing the one-inch one. It's about 8 foot tall right now. It is oak, and I'm concerned about oak wilt transferring. I'm also looking at moving this small one from Platteville to Janesville. I have a friend that's there that lost their trees, and I'm looking at transplanting it. When can I transplant it? Concern about oak wilt?
Okay. All right. Thank you, Gary. About 2-3 minutes to answer that question, Mark.
Sure. Well, oak wilt's a huge concern, and not only in Wisconsin, but through a good portion of the Midwest. And it's transferred two ways, through root grafts. So it's primarily a problem in the red and black oak family, those oaks that have pointed leaves. So with root grafts, you think about forest situations when oak wilt settles in. It's also transferred by beetles during the growing season that feed on oaks and spread it. And so the short answer is I wouldn't worry so much about oak wilt if it's not showing symptoms and it's not in a situation where it's there's been any issues of an injury or other oak wilt symptoms in the area. Moving it during the dormant season is just fine. You could do it this week if you wanted. I wouldn't move them in leaf, you know, so that's typically, you know, late May into, you know, through the summer months. The concern is getting enough of the root system. So to me, it's less about oak wilt and timing. It's more about getting as much of the roots as you can and move them on a shady day, get them in the ground, and get them watered. But if the oak wilt to me is not a concern at this point. But for folks that don't know anything about oak wilt, do a little more research on it because it can wipe out, again, grows of oaks very quickly, again, in that red and black oak family. The white oaks, the rounded leaf oaks, bur oaks, et cetera, tend to wall it off and can kind of get through that process. But it is a concern for sure.
Could be devastating for oaks for sure. So you should be pruning those in like, February or March to avoid that? Is that the time frame?
Yeah, December through March,
okay.
not during the growing season. It's the wounds that attract the beetles.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. All right, well, our guest today on Garden Talk is Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Stay with us because there's always more to come on the Ideas Network. Listening to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Mark Dwyer. He's a speaker, educator, and author and has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. His business is called Landscape Prescriptions by MD. What gardening questions do you have? Join the conversation. 800-642-1234 or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And one more thing I wanted to get to before the show's done. It's about time to start cleaning up our garden. How much should we actually do in the fall?
Well, great question, Jill. It's really a subjective decision. And if you had asked me this 10 years ago, I probably would have had a different answer because I think most folks are hearing nowadays that leaving some debris up in your garden is beneficial for area wildlife. Certain pollinators that might be cavity dwellers or like hollow stems or that garden debris that provides some winter sheltering. So the idea of having a totally cut back, pristine, clean garden, the benefit, of course, is you don't have to deal with it in spring, but it has a lot less value for our native wildlife. So there's a lot of push now for kind of a 50-50 mix, you know, clean up some of the stuff that'll be more problematic in spring or kind of mushy or difficult to deal with, but leave some elements up in your landscape. We should be doing that, of course, with our grasses and some of our perennials that provide seeds for birds. And again, many of us already do this. But to your original question, Jill, it really is up to the personal gardener. And leaving some of that work till spring is not a bad idea for, again, providing that wildlife value.
Okay. And as far as your leaves, are you a recycler of your leaves? Do you use them as mulch? Because there's so many I see in the curb, there's so many leaves, and I'm like, don't waste those. What do you do with yours?
Well, we actually, very few leaves leave our property at home. So we're either putting them in our compost pile or we're mowing them into the turf. You know, mm-hmm. We have a very small lawn. It's mostly garden. But most of the leaves we're using in our compost pile. So that's an element that can be repurposed in our garden. And I mentioned earlier my wife and I picking up mums that folks have discarded. When I see really finely shredded leaves along the curbside that people are dumping out as well, I might collect some of those as well and use those as a winter mulch here and there. So there are ways, again, to reuse these leaves. And, you know, think about the woods, our forests, our state forests around the state, they're, you know, nobody's raking and collecting the leaves. They're benefiting
No.
that soil level and all those plants. So,
right.
consider the value of reincorporating that material somewhere in your garden.
Yes, absolutely. So that was my soapbox. So thank you for supporting me on that. Mary Sue in West Bend, you have a question about a maple tree. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I moved into a home 4.5 years ago that has a large maple on the front lawn that had been hit by lightning maybe 2 years before. And there was a scorch mark on the trunk facing the road, and facing the house there was a split in the bark. Well, as the years have gone by, that split has gotten larger, but it also seems to have dried up underneath, and the tree looks gorgeous except for four smaller branches that are completely dead. Should I remove those?
Well, without seeing it, it's tough to say. And, you know, a lightning strike can cause damage that perpetuates over the years. And you alluded to the fact that one of the cracks has become more prominent. I would encourage you to get a certified arborist. You know, call a tree service that has a certified arborist to take a look at it. And they'll give you a very quick decision on it, whether it's based on improving the health of the tree, or it's a safety issue or ornamentality. But it's... You know, I'm always wary of just suggesting removal until, you know, someone gets a good look at it. So the fact that it's doing beautifully sounds great. So I would just get another set of eyes on the tree. And again, a certified arborist is the way to go.
Okay. Thanks, Mary Sue. Lisa in Oconomowoc, what can we help you with today?
Hi. My vegetable garden is about 25 years old, and it's getting kind of tired and feeling sorry for itself. I have access to horse manure, and so I've started bringing some home in 5-gallon buckets, which I plan on aging over the winter just in a pile out back. But I don't know how much horse manure to actually bring home for the spring. And my thought is, well, we haven't been rototilling because we didn't want to break up the soil composition, but for the manure, I'm thinking we need to rototill it in. So just general thoughts on that.
Well, you're doing a lot of things right. If your question was, what's the best product I could use to regenerate a vegetable garden? If that was it, I would have said, hey, can you find some horse manure? I'm a huge proponent of aged horse manure. And for 21 years, we used it at Rotary Gardens as an amendment for vegetable gardens, annual beds. And it was aged. You know, it had sat for a little bit, so it wasn't steaming fresh, of course. And we were adding an inch or two every year. And these are, again, were in beds that were growing ornamentals and veggies and mixing it into the soil. Your comment about rototilling people should take to heart, because a danger with rototilling is you can adversely affect the structure of the soil. Despite it looking nicely churned up and such and easier to work with, you do disrupt the soil to a certain degree. But to your question about how do I incorporate this manure into the soil, if kind of forking it in by hand or mixing it is problematic, you could do a light till. I mean, I've that's one of the best ways to get that manure into that top layer of soil. But you really can't overdo it by adding just a couple inches to rejuvenate the soil. And the fact that you have that product already and know that you have to age it is the first step. Incorporating it, of course, will be the next. But if you have to rototill it, that's just what you have to do.
Okay, thanks, Lisa. Let's go next to Tom in Door County. Hi, Tom. Tom, are you there?
I'm sorry. Yes, I am. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
I'm a hollyhock lover, and I've had some family ones for years, and I was very fortunate to get some very colorful seed pods dried up from a neighbor, and I've tried planting those before, both in the fall and the spring, without success. Do you have any advice for that?
Yeah, hollyhocks. I'm a huge fan as well, and I have a patch in my backyard that it's mostly pinks and whites, and a huge fan of that flower. And I do two things with the seed, actually. It's good you mentioned this because it's an old-fashioned plant that is traditionally considered a biennial, which means from germination, the first year is foliage, the second year is the flower. However, there's some now modern hollyhocks that bloom the first year from seed. But back to what I do, I actually will sprinkle about half the seeds at ground level and in my patch, and the other half I just take in dry and put them in the crisper drawer of the fridge, and then try to start some of those seeds the next year in kind of a seeding tray, and also sprinkle some additional ones out in the garden. And I've had a self-perpetuating patch for about 25 years that's looked pretty good. So, you know, again, a lot of that seed will germinate the following year, or you have baby plants that have gone through their first year that'll bloom the next. But absolutely bring some of that seed into your fridge and save that for spring use.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Good luck with that. Hollyhocks are so pretty.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tessa in Bayfield emailed us a question. She has two vigorous trumpet vines and wondering when and how much of the vines should she prune back? It seems that they bloom on the tips of the new spring growth. Is that true? And also just a comment, a pretty vine that blooms this time of year is cobaea, or sometimes called cathedral or cups and saucers vine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the trumpet vine comment, they tend to bloom on the newer growth, which is true, but you absolutely can butcher those back severely, and they'll still bloom on that new growth. You'll get a very aggressive regrowth, so don't be shy about hacking back as needed, because it's quite a vigorous vine. The cobias, the cathedral bells, are also called cup and saucer vine. It's an annual. Folks should know that. And it does come in pink, blue, and white, but a beautiful vine. It'll be finished by frost, but of course up in Bayfield they have some lake effect there, so they're fairly warm, which is nice. But there are some amazing annual vines that go the distance and do well all the way till hard frost. And cobia, again, is one of them.
Okay, great. Thanks for the suggestion. Susan emailed. She has a large area of native flowers, but there's encroaching buckthorn. And if she mows the area in the spring, will the wildflowers still bloom but help keep back the buckthorn?
So the mowing, there's two things happening there. The mowing, the wildflower should still be okay if it's an early enough mowing. I wouldn't worry about that. My concern with the mowing the buckthorn is those cut points on a buckthorn will encourage thickening, so you'll get more growth. As a general comment, and this involves my term elbow grease, is we're heading into a time of year where the buckthorn is very conspicuous, because as all our deciduous trees lose their leaves, go through fall color, buckthorn keeps that glossy green leaf way into November. It's one of the last things holding leaves, whether it's a little 2 foot tall seedling or it's a larger one. And fall is the best time to remove buckthorn. And it's very hard to dig, but with a judicious application of a stump killer or a full strength Roundup. And again, I'm not a chemical guy, but with larger buckthorns or the buckthorns in this situation, by making a fall cut and specifically painting on some of this herbicide directly on that cut, it should track down into the roots. I've had amazing success with all sizes of buckthorn with a fall kill and not trying to deal with it in spring. So back to the mowing, you'll never get rid of the buckthorn with mowing ever. So you need to do something else with that before it really gets going in there.
Okay. Thanks for that email. And we'll go back to phones now. Sandra in Madison has a question. Hi, Sandra.
Hey, I'm just wondering. Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering if now is an okay time to take about a 15-inch slip for cloning from my friend's rose bush. It's setting hips right now. Mm. Or when is the best time of year to do that? Take a little switch for cloning.
I'm not entirely sure on that. That's a great comment. The issue with the roses, it would still have to experience some sort of dormancy. So my guess, my gut feeling is that spring would be better, to be honest. But I'm not a rose expert, so I would encourage you to maybe reach out to folks that might have a better answer. But I think my concern with this time of year is establishing your cutting and it then making sure it goes through a dormancy. You know, you can't keep it in as a house plant or anything. It does have to go through some degree of a simulated winter. So tough to say.
Okay. Thanks, Sandra. Deb in Milwaukee, you have a question?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm growing a hop vine for the first time ever. I'm in the city of Milwaukee, and I have actually two vines growing in a big barrel, whiskey barrel, and they have reached the top of my garage, and they're full of flowers. And I'm curious about harvesting the flower and wondering about when to do that. I have looked on YouTube videos about preserving them, but I don't know how hardy they are to a frost that we might be having tonight. Can you tell me more about hop vines?
Well, actually, I've never personally cultivated the flowers or collected the flowers. And it's important to mention that hops are a hardy, herbaceous vine for us, meaning when you get a hard frost, it's all going to turn brown. Now, the flowers should still be, I believe, collectible. I don't think that's an issue. I think you can still do that at post-frost. But your vine will be entirely new growth the next year. So, again, you may need to do a little research on how late you can actually collect them. But I believe it after frost is still okay. But once you do that, I would remove that vine. It's a mess to deal with, to be honest, the following year. This is a case where I would snip it all the way back to a couple of inches before the snow flies. But again, more research on the timing for your collection. I'm not sure.
And Mark, she said it was in a barrel, right? Is that going to be a problem with the winter?
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't catch that portion of it. So the barrel is an elevated growing situation. That will freeze solid like a icy cupcake. So some additional mulching, probably. Hops is extremely hardy. So I don't want to hazard and say, oh, it'll be fine. It's one of the few things I think would take a tough winter in a tub like that. But perhaps some additional mulching, or if you can move the tub to a situation in the garage or insulate it against the house or something for a little more protection. But in ground, you know, ground level would be certainly better, of course, for insulation.
I understand why she'd want to put it in a barrel, though. They're kind of prolific when you plant them. They come up everywhere.
Yeah, they can spread, and they're extremely vigorous. There's a great golden one called Nugget, which I grow, which has beautiful golden foliage, and it's not one you grow for beer or anything like that. But the hops finder, they are fun to grow, although Japanese beetles enjoy them as well, so
yes.
Something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I had that same variety, and like you said, it's beautiful. The color is gorgeous, but yeah, they definitely like to crawl. So
yeah.
Russ in Lena, Illinois called but couldn't stay with us. He has a burning bush that he's struggling with. He works on a golf course, so they're probably exposed to chemicals. They start to wilt randomly. The leaves curl up, not like a dry wilt, more like a chemical exposure wilt. Can you figure out what's going on with that?
Boy, that's tough to say. And it sounds like his theory is based on knowledge that there is some chemical use, of course, which isn't unusual in a golf course situation. So it could be drift if it's on a particular side. Tough to say. You know, I've seen struggling burning bushes tend to get fall color earlier as well. So again, the challenge would be knowing the inputs to the plant. I will say as a general comment, burning bushes that fruit that are forming those little red fruiting structures are very problematic with birds dispersing them throughout our woodlands. So burning bush is on a short list for, in many states, it's actually, I believe, on a noxious weed list. I'd be concerned about burning bush in general. For those that are showing heavy fruiting, tend to move about with seedlings. And that's just a comment I wanted to share because I've seen woodlands where there's a haze of red fall color down low. And what it is burning bush babies that still get the fall color at a couple inches tall that have just been dispersed everywhere.
Yes.
So be wary.
Very much so. Let's go next to Ken in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Ken.
Hi. We moved into a house 7 or 8 years ago now, and we inherited a rhododendron of some kind that's planted outdoors in the ground. It's not an azalea, but it looks awfully close to it. And tends to get, every year, its leaves are yellow, and almost the entire year. And so we had an arborist out who was looking at other stuff on our property, and he said, oh, you know, it's iron deficiency, you know, so use some of those Job's, you know, spikes that you put in the ground and, you know, give it some more iron. I put down some Morganite, you know, to try to give it a little bit more iron, and the leaves stay on, you know, all year, and it does flower when it's supposed to. But year after year, they're kind of pretty yellow, and so I was wondering if I'm doing something wrong, if there could be something else that is deficient in. Maybe I'm just not giving it enough iron.
Yeah, it's tough to say. Sometimes an iron deficiency is caused by a pH problem, meaning there's actually adequate iron, but a higher pH makes the iron unavailable for the plant. So the suggestion for the fertilizer spikes and Morganite is a nice light fertilizer, but I would encourage you to try some slow-release sulfur. I think my guess is, without a soil test, which you might consider as well, acidifying the soil, bringing that pH down, I think will improve everything, including the greening of those leaves. And you'll have a lot less of that chlorosis, which tends to be deceptive, that it's a deficiency, that something's wrong, that's not available in the soil. But rhododendrons and azaleas universally like a lower acidic pH. So I would strive for that.
Okay, thanks, Ken, and good luck with that. Kurt in Columbia County called but couldn't stay with us, and he's wondering if they could use black walnut mulch to suppress weeds in their driveway.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Oh, boy, there's a business thought, you know. Well, that's, you know, keep in mind the comments about the walnuts, that it doesn't inhibit everything. So
right.
Tough to say. I have a feeling there would still be weeds that would have no problem. Because go to any walnut along a wood's edge, and there's plenty of things growing underneath it. So I don't know. I don't know about that. maybe worth an experiment. It could be the million-dollar idea. I don't know.
There you go. Yeah, I think that it probably wouldn't work, but way to think outside the box. That's great.
Right, right.
Dan in Madison emailed us, and he's wondering, what's the best time of year to plant evergreens?
My feeling is today, right now. And the reason I mentioned this earlier, the soil temperatures are still quite warm. Don't let air temperature dissuade you from considering some late season planting. So I feel, when I'm asked this, I feel the best time for planting evergreens is fall, and I think the second best is in spring. I just avoid the heat of summer. So what happens with fall establishment now is warm soils for root growth. You provide plenty of watering before that ground freezes, and they settle in real nicely and get a jump in spring. So we're heading into a time of year where your local nurseries and garden centers may be having sales. And look for those lapses of conifers and evergreens in your landscape now even, and get some good deals and dig some holes. I plant evergreens well into November in southern Wisconsin here, and have had very few losses.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because there are some deals out there, so take a look. And as far as watering goes, though, we really need to keep watering those, right?
Absolutely, and, you know, it's deceptive sometimes when we're digging. We think, that looks pretty moist, but in our area, we haven't had rain in weeks now, and we do need to provide adequate water in our entire garden and for our turf areas as we head into the coldest portion of the winter, because those... that's the water that's going to carry our plants through and give them a boost in spring as well. So I don't shut off the water at home until after Thanksgiving, typically.
Ah, that makes sense. How often do we water?
You want to add that 1 inch a week. So give a good soak. A deeper soak is better than infrequent, you know, a little over the top. So give a deep soak at least once a week for the next month or so.
Okay, sounds good. Well, thank you, Mark. We really, really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Jill.
We've been talking with Mark Dwyer. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. I'm Jill Najoe, in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk today. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well and enjoy your weekend.